But this woman came, and she had a beautiful, beautiful voice, and she sang Home Sweet Home. And we were all just sitting there dying, and her strange accent, you know, trying to, and then towards the end, she broke down. I started to sing with her, and I looked up, and her face was just, I don't know how she did it. I mean, I don't know how she sang and cried at the same time. The tears were all down her face, and she had a son on the front, and it was Christmas Eve, you know, so, ah.
It's hard to imagine the, where their heads are, you know, I mean, there's no other way to say it. The kind of total fear they have of being annihilated at any time, and yet the kind of confidence and strength they seem to exude.
And I don't know about the fear. I mean, I was certainly aware of the fear in myself, but when I questioned the members of our own group, you know, like I asked Telford Taylor, I said, do you have fear when you go down to the shelter? He said, oh, not really. I'm sort of, as you know, some, but not extensive, and I feel relatively safe if you're prudent about getting down to the shelter. He was so fucking rational about it. And then Mike said, not really, that he thought about his family a lot. By the way, wrote out his last will and testament while we were sitting down there. And Barry slept through half the damn raids. You know, I'd go knock on the door and say, Barry, you know, leave me alone. And because he said he got in trouble in his own unit for doing that, because they'd say everybody in the shelter, and he'd say, let me sleep. You know, so, and so if our own people had that little kind of fear, then I'm sure that the local people, you know, I mean, the kids are giggling and horsing around. And when the bombing really gets loud and you're in the shelter and you have to pop your ears, you know, and your clothes flutter with the wind, even down inside the shelter, everything flutters. There's a funny fluttering in your ears and your clothes. Then they kind of shake their heads and put their fingers in their ears. And the minute it goes away, they're laughing again and playing again.
We got one report from the French press agency, I think it was, that said that, or maybe it was the doctor, the head of Bach Nye, who made the statement that every family in Hanoi was mourning somebody over Christmas weekend. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, it seems about average. Everybody that we knew had lost either their entire house or a member of their family. One of the members of the committee had lost his 8 children, and his wife had been wounded and lost. They couldn't find her. He never heard from her, but when we left, he had not yet heard of her, and that was the first bombing night.
And even after experiences like that, they carry on?
They just carry on. I mean, I don't know how the hell they do it, but they just go on.
What are you going to do now? Does this set any new directions for you in terms of your priorities for the time ahead?
Mostly it's an energy booster, and then I'm just going to have to figure out, because I've got to get home and say, oh, hi, Mimi, I think she's listening, and get home this evening, see my kids, and see the family, and talk about it for a while, and then try to decide what from there. Thanks so much, by the way.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. That's Joan Baez, who's just returned from Hanoi. This is Bruce Soloway with Dick Dominus, the engineer, at the Committee of Liaison with American Prisoners of War in Vietnam. Let me see who else is still here. I've been sitting and talking to Joan and haven't been able to look around. Let's see if... Dick, can you take a look around the back and see if Telford Taylor is around there? Maybe I can go with you. Let's see. This is impromptu radio. Hang on, folks.
The Reverend Barry.
Yeah, they're all back there. If it's okay with you, Gary, why don't you play another couple of songs, and I'll see if I can get somebody else to come here and talk with us, okay?
Sure, Bruce. Okay. Meeting sponsored by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She was introduced by Julie Shulman, a member of that organization. This program was produced by Richard Harris and Bert Grossman, and is a rebroadcast of last evening's Extra.
And it seemed to me, in that moment, as I talked to that survivor, this woman who had only lived because she had been between two layers of corpses, that perhaps we had become the Germans.
Many of you heard an interview with Gloria Emerson, which Nick Eagleson did on WBAI, and those who did know what a tremendously warming kind of feeling it was, and a kind of feeling that you had to get out and work harder. those of us who were aware of Miss Emerson before WBAI's interview were aware of it because we had been reading the New York Times and watching for her byline, because while we were out talking about tonnage of bombs and cost of the war and vague abstractions, she was telling us about what was going on for the people who were there. And now I'd like to present Miss Emerson. There will be unlimited time for questioning when she's through.
I don't have all the answers. I wish I did. I spent 2 years and some months in Vietnam, which was considered an unusually long time for a correspondent. Indeed, most of the correspondents, most of the press corps, stay there for 1 year. And without dramatizing it, I can truthfully tell you it is almost more than one can bear. Not many reporters volunteer for Vietnam. It's not only a very dangerous assignment, but it is possibly the most demoralizing one in the world. And in a curious way, no matter how punishing those 2 years in Vietnam were, coming back to the United States, where I grew up, I'm a New Yorker, has almost been as punishing in an odd way as being in Vietnam, because people have not been paying attention. And when I came back to the United States, and I haven't lived here in a decade, I'd been a foreign correspondent for the Times, many of the friends I hadn't seen in many years asked me questions about Vietnam, and they would say, what did you wear? And what did you eat? And indeed, one woman even said, what did you wear to officers' dances? And only recently in Cambridge, a very intelligent man who's a lawyer said to me, it was worse for us than it was for you. And I didn't say anything. I've learned not to quarrel. And he said it was worse for us watching it on television because it left so much to the imagination. And I said, you were wrong, because while you were imagining, I was witnessing the unimaginable. Some of the questions that people have asked me on my return from Vietnam is, do you think there'll be a bloodbath? And I say, no, the bloodbath is taking place, has taken place, the American bloodbath. And while this seems a very melodramatic statement to make, it is quite true. I have not lived through a B-52 bombing. Nobody lives through a B-52 bombing. I have seen B-52 bombings. I have been miles and miles away and felt the earth shake and tremble and felt the pressures on my ears. Once I was with some reporters when a cluster bomb was dropped on us by mistake. A cluster bomb is one of the United States' more sophisticated weapons. I won't give you a vocabulary of the weapons we use in the air war. They are horrifying, but I wish you could see the victims. And a cluster bomb was dropped on a group of reporters, and we saw very clearly what it can do. I have seen what the American anti-personnel weapons can do. These are weapons designed not just to kill people, but to mutilate them. For a man that is mutilated is more trouble to his own army than he would be if he was dead. So we have been manufacturing weapons primarily to drop on the Ho Chi Minh Trail or in areas in South Vietnam where we feel there are large concentrations of enemy troops or guerrillas. We have been designing weapons not to kill men, but to mutilate them. It's very hard to give coherence to the Vietnam experience. To live through 2 years and some months and come back and say, I have 10 things I want to tell you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And indeed, the ideal for all of us who have been in Vietnam would be never to talk about it again, for it's what we most want to forget. But I do talk about it because I have this curious obsession about paying my dues, that it would be something close to evil to have been in Vietnam and not come back and tell you of the horror of this war, of the absolute futility of it, and of its victims. And its victims were not just the Vietnamese. Its victims were us as well. And in Indochina, one saw many level of victims. And one level, you may have had the young American GI from North Dakota who had never been abroad, who knew nothing of the history of Vietnam, who had just been through basic training, and then who was shipped to Vietnam, who was fearful, who was nervous, anxious to prove himself, anxious to stay alive, who would go through a Vietnamese village and see nothing of its beauty, see nothing of its civilization, not see that its people were handsome and fine, that boy might go through a village and look at people he called dinks and see them as dirty and insignificant in huts without toilets. And it may have been repellent. I have talked to veterans who are sorry for what they did in Vietnam. And our great tragedy, of course, is there is no one to whom we can say we are truly sorry and be forgiven. I think there is no one to forgive us. People have asked me what my most painful moment in Vietnam was. It's very hard to pick a painful moment, for I moved with the American Army, and I moved with the South Vietnamese Army, and I talked to prisoners of war, and I was in Vietnamese villages when American line companies moved through. And I have been in villages where Cobra gunships open fire and kill some of the people in those villages. But I think the worst moment, the moment where I feared for a second that what had become unglued in me might never be glued again, was standing at the ditch in a village we know as My Lai. I had gone to My Lai in 1970 to talk to the people there, and was talking to a woman who had survived the massacre at My Lai, and she told me how some of the American soldiers in Charlie Company had rounded up the Vietnamese in this small hamlet and asked some of them to step in the ditch and lie down and be shot, and then more Vietnamese would enter the ditch. And I, who was born in 1930, could only remember pictures from another war where Germans had done this. And it seemed to me, in that moment, as I talked to that survivor, this woman who had only lived because she had been between two layers of corpses, that perhaps we had become the Germans. South Vietnam had a presidential election in October 1971, and our office was in Saigon, and I covered the presidential election and had already been in Vietnam for quite some time, and had been in the habit of writing some of the parents of some of the GIs I had seen, who were very young and who hardly knew where they were. And sometimes I would write their mothers, "Dear Mrs. Smith, I saw your son today. He is okay." And sometimes I would write them, and a long time after, they would write me back and say, I knew I was right to worry about Tommy or Jim. He was badly wounded. He died. And sometimes the letters would show that the parents thought that their sons had died to make South Vietnam a democracy. And I never had the courage, and I never will have the courage, to write them and say, no, they did not die to make South Vietnam a democracy. And I will give you an example of how life in South Vietnam, a country run by government, we have indeed created and supported and maintained, operates. There was a presidential election. The 17 million people of South Vietnam were to go to the polls and choose a president. And in many ways, Washington was very pleased about this, because it would indeed show the world that South Vietnam, where 50,000 of us had died, 50,000 whites, 50,000 Americans had died, was a democracy. A definition of a democracy is a place where you go and vote for the president of your choice. There was one problem. There was only one candidate for this presidential election. One candidate, and he happened to be the man who had already held office, President Nguyen Van Thieu. And Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker and the officials of the American embassy were very distressed. You have to have two men in an election, they said to themselves. What will the world say? What will public opinion in America say if only one man is running for office in South Vietnam? And in all these years, doing this long and costly involvement, we have said we are fighting in South Vietnam to make it a democracy. Ambassador Bunker went and visited several Vietnamese politicians who had followings of their own, and they refused to run. And I dare say we offered them substantial rewards to run. So desperate were we to give the impression that indeed this is a democracy. And they refused. And I was very proud of these men for refusing, for they could not have won. And they were not going to run and once more be used by the Americans in what they considered a charade. And the nephew of President Nguyen Van Thieu, a gentleman called Mr. Nha, said to a New York Times reporter in Saigon, we are going to win this election by 93.6%, somewhere around there. And I traveled throughout the countryside near Saigon, asking people what they felt. And this was always very difficult. The Vietnamese, as you well know, do not look upon us as their allies. Perhaps I was saved because I was a woman, but in many villages it first had to be established I was a woman. I speak some Vietnamese, shamefully not more, and I could hear villagers often saying when I appeared, so long and so thin was I, that they would say, what is it? For the GIs also had long hair and also had dirty faces and also looked scrawny. And one man that I talked to when I asked him about this election where only one person ran, and if he believed that you could really vote against President Thieu, because there were some provisions on the ballot where if you didn't like Thieu, you could make a mark on his face. Indeed, which of us would make a mark on the face of President Nguyen Van Thieu when the whole village saw, despite the fact that there were secret ballots, there were police and militia and village officials and district officials, and all you had to do to know how you voted was to simply pluck the last ballot that had been put in the box and say, hey, you stop. And I asked one old man in a Honda repair shop, I said, if you don't like President Thieu, and he did not like President Thieu, for he felt President Thieu was a puppet of the Americans and was something less than Vietnamese, something less than Vietnamese. And I said, well, look, why are you going to vote for him? And I have never forgotten his answer. He said to me in Vietnamese, and I translate for you, living under this sky, we do as we are told. And that was October 1971, 10 years after the first recorded American casualty. And I speak constantly of our casualties because I'm really not persuaded we care much about their casualties, which are horrendous, which go beyond numbers. As far as we know, the number of civilians killed in Indochina during the war, and do remember that we have a far greater weaponry, as it is called, a far greater level of violence than the guerrillas of the National Liberation Front or the North Vietnamese. The number of civilians killed in the Indochina War is 6 million. And again, to a New Yorker who went to public schools in New York, the very numbers, 6 million, are like an old and dreaded curse to hear them again. There was a program. There were many pacification programs in Vietnam, and you should know about them, and I'll just tell you about one. It was called the Phoenix Program, and it was created by the Central Intelligence Agency probably towards the end of 1967, and the idea was to weed out the Viet Cong, the civilian Viet Cong, from other people in the village. This then would be the equivalent of my going through this room with the powers to arrest you and by looking at your faces say, all who were for McGovern will go to jail, or all who were for Nixon. How do I know from your faces, from your clothes, from your eyes, what your political sympathies are? The Phoenix Program, which of course was thought up by the Central Intelligence Agency and is so many of the very worst and horrendous and foolish and inefficient things in Indochina where was paid for by the Americans. The Phoenix Program then was an attempt to get the leaders of the National Liberation Front and separate them from the civilian population. But we forgot two things. We forgot, although it looked fine on paper, it looked like a glorious plan on paper, we forgot two things. There would be no way of finding them, for many of the Vietnamese would not know who the most important of the leaders of the National Liberation Front were. If I were a woman in the National Liberation Front, unemployed, say, as a messenger, I might know you, and I might know you, but I certainly would not know who the intelligence officer for the province was. Nor under great duress would I tell who my contacts were. Under the Phoenix Program, Vietnamese were picked up and interrogated. And the interrogations again would have done credit to the Germans. We had something splendid, and I must tell you this regardless of how unpleasant it is for you to hear this, so that we really do not have any illusions now that we are any better than most people. Large numbers of Vietnamese were then picked up under the Phoenix Program because the Americans established quotas. The Americans said, in Province A, so many Vietnamese must be picked up under the Phoenix Program. And the word went down from the province chief to the district chief to the village chief. So many people must be picked up under the Phoenix Program. Because you see, the Americans ran the war by charts and graphs. And if you said in each of the 44 provinces, so many Vietnamese must be picked up by the Phoenix under the Phoenix Program to detect the Viet Cong sympathizers or activists, then you could write a marvelous report at the end of each month, saying, so many Viet Cong sympathizers or agents have been picked up. See how well it's going. And while you may think what I'm saying is too simplistic, it is not. So one saw all over Vietnam a very curious system of justice and this so-called democracy taking place. And one rapidly realized that the Phoenix Program was going to fail, for they were not picking up the high-ranking Viet Cong leaders. They were picking up women and children who admittedly did play a role in helping the Viet Cong. Sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But it was though they were throwing nets out and pulling everyone in. And there was torture, and there was detention. And then you would come before a so-called tribunal, which would be composed of the policemen from the very district which had arrested you, the people responsible for meeting the quotas. And one of my last and most painful visits in Vietnam was to a village called Hoa Loi in Binh Duong province, where a Vietnamese who was a deputy village chief for security came up to me and said, "Can you try and help us? The men from the Phoenix program are coming at night, and they are not even from our village. They are from the district. And they are coming and arresting people in the middle of the night and dragging them off." And I talked to two people who had recently been released from jail, and one of them had borrowed what to an Asian peasant is a huge amount of money. A huge amount of money to get out of jail. And what my suspicion is that the Phoenix program, aside from its highly immoral aspects, had become a device for enabling the Vietnamese police to bribe a poor and tortured peasant population. And I often ask myself if these marvelous plans that were conceived by so many Harvard men in dark suits in Washington who never saw the end results, I asked myself if those plans did not help the National Liberation Front. If those plans that looked so splendid on paper would not have pushed a Vietnamese of no political philosophy at all into the arms of the guerrillas. The only prisoners of war that I ever talked to knew very little about Marxism or communism or Trotskyism, or perhaps they chose not to tell me. This is open to dispute. A man who has just been taken a prisoner of war and expects to be shot or tortured, as they were, is not a man able to very fluently indulge in abstract conversation. But I must tell you this. I did have a friend who joined the National Liberation Front, and I had known his father when I was in Vietnam in 1956. And when I went back to Vietnam after 15 years, I went to see the father who was gone. He had fought against the French in the War of Independence, and he had fought in the Viet Minh, which was a communist-led national movement. And he was not there when I got back, and I gave small presents to his son and his wife. And the son one day came to say goodbye to me. And he didn't say, "I'm going to join the front." He just said, "I won't see you again." And I said, "Well, where are you going, Mr. Look?" And he said, "I'm going away." And I said, "Don't go. Don't do it. The war will be over soon. You want to finish your studies." And he didn't say anything, and he looked rather nervous, and I knew he wanted to go. And I said to him, "Why are you going?" And he said, in French, "To be Vietnamese. To be Vietnamese. To be Vietnamese." There was a tremendous anti-Americanism in South Vietnam. It was almost impossible to walk through the streets of Saigon without being robbed, either your watch or your handbag or your cameras, by bands of marauders. And I like to think it wasn't because they wanted our cheap watches. I mean, who would want this watch? It cost $6. It was made by the army. It wasn't because they wanted our watches so much as if they were acting out something, those young cowboys on Hondas in Vietnam. Listen, I promise you, I never, never, in 2 years and a few months, met a Vietnamese who said, "Go back and tell the people of America who have given us so much, thank you." I never did. There are no statues in South Vietnam on behalf of American soldiers. No South Vietnamese ever said to me to come back and say thank you. And they are not an insensitive people. The morale of the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam, which we have been training and equipping, which is now up to 1 million men, is deplorable. And during the offensive this spring, we saw how that without American air power, that army, in which two of its crack divisions broke, retreated, ran, we saw now that despite all these years of talk by the American military, who I must say are not men always noted for their truthfulness,